many years ago, I used to study graphology, which is handwriting analysis. And I found that it was really a good complement to astrology. Because in astrology, you had to cast a horoscope, and you had to ponder it. And then if you wanted to know what was going on now, you had to do the math to progress it. And then you had more to ponder, and it was an enormous amount of information. Astrology is very, very valuable for what you can derive from it, especially in regard to your spiritual life. But you got to be willing to do a lot of work and take a lot of time. For most people, astrology gives much more information than they can handle, and especially if they're trying to ponder the meaning of their life. Graphology, on the other hand, is immediate. It tells you where the person is right now, and you don't need to do any math. There isn't as much information, and you can't get to the deeper things of past lives and things like that that you can from astrology, but if all you need is a quick read, graphology works really well. On top of that, graphology can be used surreptitiously, because all you need is a sample of somebody's handwriting. Oh no. Is a sample of somebody's handwriting, which you can get sometimes without their even knowing it. And there isn't an awkwardness barrier as there is when somebody is presenting you with a date and wanting to have a face interaction. And at that time I was fascinated by it, because handwriting is sort of like liquid character. Liquid character that gets frozen right on the paper as script. It's a historical record of where the person is and what they're doing. Now these days there isn't a lot of people that write with longhand anymore. They do, they don't use pen and ink, so a lot of the attributes of handwriting are lost. So it's not easy always to get unself-conscious samples the way it used to be. Anyway, I was very enthused about handwriting analysis, and what happens when you get enthused about something is you begin to talk about it. And when you talk about it, that always means trouble. And one day, I was talking with friends down in the Students' Union, and I was talking about handwriting. And a very pretty young woman asked me to say a few words about her handwriting. And I've always been a sucker for a pretty face. Always. I always have had a hard time saying no. And so I did what I always do when I'm in a spot in the good old bad days. I talked. What happened was that the handwriting showed several tendencies to dishonesty. And it also showed tendencies to temerity, to be bold. And I didn't know what to do, and I was a little embarrassed to broach the subject, but I got up the courage, and in language that was very direct, but not necessarily harsh, but not gentle either, I told her that she had criminal tendencies. Criminal tendencies, and if she didn't watch out, she could get herself into big trouble. Now, other people in the group that were sitting around there were a bit shocked. But she wasn't at all. She didn't even bat an eye about it. And what she did is she proceeded to tell me that she was currently under indictment for larceny. I didn't know whether it was grand larceny or petty larceny, but she had a trial that was pending under the district attorney. She was impressed by the accuracy of graphology, and she wanted to know if I could tell her what the outcome of the trial was going to be. And I said, no, something like that can't be determined by graphology. And I was cautious enough not to mention astrology, by which means you could perhaps tell what the outcome of it was going to be. I saw her only once or twice since then, so I never knew what happened. It was obvious from the conversation with her that she didn't have reform in mind. She was not about to be reformed because she liked the glamour of a risky life. And beside that, she had to support her pretty boyfriend, who was a junkie and who partially supported himself as a catbird. I learned as much from talking with her as I did otherwise. I learned one of those lessons that I've learned time and again. Pretty isn't always good. But if she had wanted to reform, it would have raised some interesting issues. Issues that I have thought about for years. Suppose, let's take a slightly different case. And let's suppose that look at a handwriting or a horoscope and you can see there are tendencies to dishonesty. But instead of temerity, suppose there is timidity. You can see that this person is coming to you because they want to change. But what it becomes important and what becomes critical is the order of operations in change. Obviously, if you change the timidity first, you're going to have somebody that's going to be bold and it's going to be like the first person that we were talking about. And so the order of operations is very, very important. And it's something that applies to just about everything that we do. This talk is going to be somewhat about the order of operations. If we look at cultural history, we can see that there is a clear tendency in the order of operations. For most of the past recorded history, it was the sacred sector, the priests and the philosophers, that were the origin of culture. Cultural movements, cultural advances, moral developments very often came out of the mystery schools. They were the leaders. And mystics claim that the initiates had inward information that they could get behind history and understand its purpose and try to understand what things meant. Now this order of operations is probably as it should be. Things should proceed from those who know, and who really know, like the initiates, to those who do not know. And that's usually from the sacred to the profane. However, over the centuries, our fall into matter has progressed to the point that materialism is now very dominant in the world. And with material blindness, many people doubt the existence of the mysteries or things spiritual. Their values are in the real things. They want to gratify themselves materially, and they aren't at all interested in some deeper meaning behind things, especially if it means personal sacrifice for some greater kind of development. So, by this and other means, materialism has made it very difficult, and the adversary is probably party to it, for those who would find the mysteries to really find the mysteries. Because they're not, you know, there are a few little things like a class with four people in it that tries to expostulate mystery wisdom. And this condition has gone so far that there's an inversion such that some people who call themselves seekers appeal to blind materialistic science to validate spirituality rather than having science issue from spirituality and where the methods of investigation are so much better. And so we have this quantum physics that pervades everything. And it's used to try to justify just about anything. So, trying to explain the greater by something that is lesser is obviously absurd. But sometimes people want validation. Practice of the order of operations proceeding from matter to spirit is not completely wrong. It's part of the whole picture. As long as the matter, in a blind sense, doesn't lead itself. In many ways, it's perfectly appropriate, as we're going to see, if it's done correctly. Now sometimes, those joy times, there are moments of convergence when things proceeding from within out and those from without in converge. And they coincide in a moment so that one can understand the inner purpose and the outer effect of something. Reality, those streams meet each other. And if our attitude is correct in applying them, they both assist each other. So the coincidental union of both streams, if we make it a matter of intention in our consciousness, can be carried out through a parallelism whereby there is a which within state in awareness of what is going on in history. Cultural advancement in history are all about progress, which is just another way of saying that ultimately, even though it might not seem so in some short senses, ultimately everything is getting better. Progress, which is why we are discussing method of operations and progress in this talk. This is the Aquarian Age talk. Coincidental moments, as we've just spoken of them, where there's a convergence, are sometimes productive of cultural movements. So sometimes one stream leads the other. And it's, they both help. I'm not saying it any other way. For example, science, or better said, technology, had to develop so that a steel frame could be made before you could have a pianoforte, an instrument that you could play both loud and soft. Unlike a harpsichord, which you could only off. So there had to be a technical advance before there could be a cultural advance in the arts. Some coincidental moments come right down to one day. And one of those examples is the birthday of Abraham Lincoln, who was surely someone that was leader of cultural progress, a leader ideas. He was bold enough, even though many people were against him, he was bold enough to say that one person cannot own another person. Another person can be free, or all people can be free. Well, it turns out that on the same day that Abraham Lincoln was born, there was on the other side of the ocean somebody else was born who was a scientific leader or a person of progress, and that was Charles Darwin. Yes, this is going to be a talk about evolution. In fact, the title of the talk is Evolution and the Aquarian Age. Finally, we get to something. The purpose of this talk is to explore progress and the kinds of Aquarian attitudes which promote progress. This is meant to be a practical talk, or it's going to seem like anything but that. Now, in doing this talk, I have to be very, very forbearant because the topic of evolution is hugely vast and one could spend many lectures on it. In fact, someday I hope to do that very thing. Spend a lot of lectures and draw a lot of information out of it. And one has to be forbearant because it is a subject we're going to be presenting it, the idea, from the vantage point of the modern mystery schools, because they seem to have the most progressive attitudes about evolution, and even though the concept of evolution in mystery schools and in spiritual teachings has been around for thousands of years. Most notably, we're going to use ideas from the Rosicrucian mystery school. Of course, as always, it will be as I see it, which may be good and it may not be good. So it's going to be an original kind of outlook on it. This is going to be as simple and as short as I can make it without distorting the conceptions, just to get some evolutionary ideas. All right, let's continue from where we left off a moment ago. Let's ask a question. Why would the concept or concepts of evolution be introduced to humanity through the vehicle of profane materialistic science instead of schools where it has been known for an extremely long time? Why would that be? That's a question I've asked myself. This is one of those, again, one of those questions, which thing do you correct first, or which way do you go about something? The only way that I can the only thing that I can conclude about that was that it was a matter of exigency. As a consequence of our voluntarily choosing an excess and an indulgence in material experience, we upset our balance so that there wasn't a proper balance and a parallelism between insight and experience. And because of this imbalance, we've driven ourselves into material blindness. In fact, all of our security for most people is in matter. And the effect of that is that it slows things down. When you make a lot of mistakes and have to do the same things over again and again, it slows things down quite a bit. You have to go back and correct them. But in attitude, it has also slowed things down because we tend to cling to forms. Matter certainly is turgid compared to spirit, which is quickness, with its quickness and, it's alive. Everything is instantaneous in the moment. So this slowdown is probably caused by the same selfishness that caused us to indulge in personal experience in the first place. And this affects everything in culture. And it turns out that when the equinox is precessing through water and earth signs, those are called negative polarity signs, the children of water, the priests, and the religious people are in charge. When the equinox precesses through fire and air signs, things switch over so that the philosophers and now the scientists are in charge because they are the children of fire and they have that kind of attitude. So that at the same time that materialism is really, really slowing things down, it happens to be the time where the church is in ascendancy. And so the church had a very strong grip on things, a strong enough grip on things, so that the transition to philosophy and science could not take place at a rate that was fast enough. So, by putting it in the hands of a material scientist, that was not dominated by the church, but that was yet culturally developed, they were able, the forces that are behind our human cultural evolution were able to break the hold that was held by the church, even though it meant now having to deal with a very strong materialistic science. And it did that. It broke the whole illusion, but what it did is produced a new illusion that science and technology, in the material sense, are the be-all, end-all. And so we now have a new question: what do we do? How do we deal with materialism? Some people have spent their entire life in that very thing, trying to counter materialism or break through it or find an alternate way. Rudolf Steiner claims that this is one of the primary reasons for his entire life. One of my personal views is that it's probably wisest to take the middle path, path that balances between spirit and matter, between science and religion, and just simply state and present the mysteries tradition without being overly inward or without being overly outward. In doing that, which is what we're going to try and do in the next few minutes, one's just presenting to people and then allowing them for themselves decide whether this is true or not, whether this is a path to follow. Evolution is a fact. To anyone who has sufficient spiritual perception or intuition that can see that. We're not talking about looking at fossil records. We're not looking at what would you call it? Physiology, animal physiology, or anything like that. We're talking about being able to spiritual perception to see things metamorphize and evolve through various states of being. Creation is a fact. Anyone who has sufficient spirituality and intuition can see self, that there is creation, that there are new things. By participating, one can understand that. creation and evolution are not mutually exclusive. They are the purpose and the method for obtaining the same end. In creation, we find purpose. In evolution, we find method. Now, when we talk about the word evolution, we do not mean Darwinism or any of the other materialistic theories that go by the name of evolution. Evolution, as seen by the mysteries, is not a process that is begun by random circumstances and controlled by blind laws, the origin of all of which is unknown, and the end of everything having no purpose. That's not our view of evolution. Evolution is an orderly process to fulfill divine we say creation, we don't mean something instantaneous and magical and a personal activity that's at the whim of a divinity. We don't mean that at all either. There are people, you know, that actually believe that, I have a friend that is a librarian in an institution. He's had people tell him that God put those fossils there are people that actually have those kinds of notions. Creation is not a dazzling demonstration of divinity to excite worship as if it couldn't do it any other way. It may be dazzling, but it doesn't have to speak to something like that. It is good, it is beautiful, it is true, and it is reality. Reverence and devotion. In creation, the universal, eternal spirit fulfilled the purpose of its basic being. And its basic nature is given. Now, we have to immediately put all kinds of on ourselves, we have to hasten to clarify that it's just not possible to grasp and understand the eternal spirit, at least not with our human consciousness, since we have to have. We have to have a real link beyond some spiritual state to do that. We do glimpses, and we do feel inklings of it in ourselves. Sometimes we have transcendental moments of awakeness, and in them we have a vague understanding of things. It's pretty like this talk, vague. If possible, and I trust that's what everyone is doing that is in this room, prepare ourselves and to develop ourselves and to intuitively align ourselves with the spirit so that we can be conscious, fully conscious of this and grow in it. It can't be any other way. We are in it. We are of it. We are it in a way, at least part of it. But it's all quite difficult to conceptualize. It is our destiny and it is our duty to conceptualize it. Each of us must ultimately, in the whole business, we must recreate it from our point of view. That is a part of our divine duty. Become in this way in our being is a large part of the purpose for our being, not the total of it. Now we have to look at some metaphysical preface talking about evolution itself, and this is one of the areas where I often find myself. I love the metaphysics of things and I get into things and excruciate too long. And in this case, I think I may have held myself a little bit in check. The universal spirit is and knows everything that is. It does not know the things that are not, but could be, because they aren't, and so that's impossible. And not even the spirit can do what is impossible, which is to know what isn't. It does know things that could be in its own dream, and it's filled with love, and it's filled with the urge to share. And in this, the universal spirit objectifies much of what is not, but what could be. It objectifies as much of that as it is capable of doing. Now, that all sounds like a lot of metaphysical gibberish. Try to bring it down to a level that's more experiential. It's an activity that happens to us in a very small way. When we learn something and we come to an understanding, as part of that understanding, we know that there is a lot that we don't know. And we are clarified not only about the things that we know, but about the potential or about the possibility of things that we don't know. This is the kind of thing that suggests the next experiment, or it's the kind of thing that produces a trajectory for a creative artist. That knowing this has suggested, well, maybe this might be the next step to go with my creative career. Now, when some people hear words like that, they become very alarmed. They consider it blasphemy. They consider it sacrilegious. Because God is everything. You don't even question that. The universal spirit loves and gives to its objectification until potential becomes. And the universal spirit becomes more of itself within itself. This is not degrading to the universal spirit. It is not limiting it. We're not saying that the universal spirit is limited. It's universal. And it doesn't distract from its omnipotence or its omniscience, because it is all-powerful in everything that is, and it knows everything that is. Doesn't detract from that at all to say that it doesn't know what is not, which is an impossibility. It's just a part of eternal being. Now, when it makes more of itself clearly to itself, that gets a little bit more difficult to understand. Again, when we're talking about becoming, we're speaking about eternal things. Not talking about instant transformations. Something, we're talking about something that dawns on consciousness over eons and eons. We have an illusion about that. We think that knowing is something that's instantaneous. Because one moment we know something, and the moment before, know that. And so we think that knowing must be like that in the divine, without realizing that. mind was a long dawning before the sun of consciousness peeked over the horizon. So that's an illusion that I believe we have to overcome if we're going to understand that. We also have the experience of things that are very deep, especially if we've been studying spiritual philosophy, that we can be aware, and in our awareness and understanding, that some things come to us very, very slowly. And it's a kind of knowledge that isn't like knowing that it's cold, it's hot. It is a kind of knowledge that is very gradual and in itself approaches eternity. And that's part of the illusion that that's part of the understanding that overcomes this illusion. It always seems to us, when we consider it in the universal spirit, that the objectifications, even of what is unknown, as hypotheticals, are external. But since everything, even things which are becoming, are in the universal spirit, they are, of course, internal. Saying this another way, externals and externalization take place within the one. All right. Obviously, we're trying to speak about very difficult things. You can see that I'm struggling to even stay in touch with my notes, which I dare not be in. We're in big trouble. We're speaking very difficult things, and we're trying to speak about the origin of the evolutionary creation. The evolution is the process. Creation is the purpose. We're speaking of an exceedingly profound thing in very prosaic consciousness that can produce all kinds of misconceptions. The best that we can hope to do in all of this is to how to say it. The best thing we can try to do is state what we know with our consciousness now. And even though that might sound trite or simplistic, we have to push that forward and then we can understand the follows. That has been my experience, that I can go back to the same things again and again and each time I go through them as a consequence of having worked on both in previous instances, they become clearer and the understanding becomes deeper. So this is meant to be a lucid area. It's not something that's going to be the be-all end-all. When we're talking about that which is not, but which could possibly be, there are obviously philosophical problems about creation, things that seem almost impossible. At least for us, we're in the philosophical mind. The artists have that kind of creative consciousness, it might not be so difficult. How does one create what isn't? Sense of potential, it could be anything. Everything about what isn't is unknown. Everything about what isn't is unknown, and it must be. But still, in spirit, we feel that it could be something marvelous. After all, it is in some kind of absolute, which is everything that is and everything that isn't. We can garner that much from what we know. when we, as ignorant and blind humans, encounter something unknown, we usually persevere in experiencing it until it becomes known. They added and added and added, and eventually we know it. With the universal spirit, it's different, because the unknown, even that which could be, is in a state of non-being. It's kind of hard to familiarize yourself with a state of non-being. It's just, there's nothing you can do to know it. Because it could be just about anything. But just about anything means what you already know. So you can see the circular problem that we have. It seems like there is an absolute, that there is a unity between what is and what is not, but that is a matter of faith, a very deep faith. You can't penetrate and say things like that, that the absolute is a unity of everything that's known and unknown from any kind of knowledgeable experience. It's something that is beyond reason. It is a matter of deeper faith, which takes us into a deeper state of spirit, which is beyond ratiocination, as we're trying to do right now. And another problem about all of this is that which is not is infinitely passive, because it's non-being. It isn't anything. It isn't actively anything. It's passive. It's almost too late to even speak about it. But spirit, this is where spirit actually transcends creative activity. It transcends itself to itself within itself. Spirit has faith in itself. And it knows that which is within itself, and it creates as an act of faith, as well as an act of love and an act of purpose. You might say it wants to share. And it has to even create something to share with itself. It projects. Universal spirit projects itself as a dream, a purposeful, creative dream into what could be. Obviously, this can be done because non-being in its infinite passivity is also by that same stroke infinitely receptive. In fact, it is so passive or so receptive that it is resistive, because any moment that attention is withdrawn from it or removed from it, it lapses back into a state of non-being. Obviously, this produces an enormous problem. One has to have almost infinite or timeless application to sustain something on the scale of evolution. It's been a difficult problem for spiritual philosophers of all ages thinking about this situation. We spoke about it in an earlier talk. We were speaking about time, and we said that it was dangerous and detrimental to speak of the future in terms of the past. We gave the example of the first time that I tasted a mango, and I described it in likeness to peaches, which was unfair to both peaches and mangoes. Obviously, if we are projecting a hypothetical from the known, which is the spirit, into what is unknown, what is being projected is a result of past experience. and we're putting it into the unknown, which is the same thing as, because the unknown in this sense is future, which is the same thing as saying a mango was like a peach, or similar in flavor to a peach. The spirit itself is much more than self-knowing from experience. There is something of spirit that transcends self-knowing from experience. In fact, this is why religious type think that that is all there is, that the knowing from experience is inconsequential. So there's a difference between manifest knowing and doing and awakening in spirit and that internal self-transcendence, which is too much to go into for now. In any case, the objectification of some of non-being by projecting a creative dream, which is and must be a self-image as well as a self-history, this can be seen as a fantasy activity, which is just what it is when a painter does the same thing before making the painting, saying, "Wouldn't this be beautiful? Or would I like to share this with my friends?" Now, in fact, in a lot of spiritual philosophies, a lot of people believe that's what all of creation is. They feel it's all an illusion. And the best thing to do is to escape that illusion by transcending it as soon as possible, not realizing that seeing all of the creation as a purposeless fantasy has the universal spirit indulging in something which is meaningless, something which is without purpose, which goes counter to all the facts. The more we understand things of the creation, especially self-conscious creative beings, the more we understand how deeply purposeful everything is. This is one of those practical things. There are the illusionists, and they are found in almost every religion, that feel that it is only an illusion. So what is important is the realization of the dream. That is, making it real, which is what the evolutionary process is all about. The evolutionary process is all about realizing the dream. It is about taking something that is heretofore unknown, because it was heretofore in a state of non-being, and realizing it. It is a matter of living a dream to reality. In a very faint, small way, we find that in a lot of our human activities, that they are a matter of being nothing but fantasy until we live them into existence. But in reality, to make something exist at all is a much deeper level of that same thing. This is one of those things that analogy always works in spiritual philosophy. Things that we experience every day are just minutiae of principles that are at the fundamental beginning of all creation, or the fundamental source of all ever becoming that takes place in the universal spirit. Often the process of evolution is called an evolutionary scheme. the means of applying attention of the universal spirit to realize something out of a potential state. Sometimes it is called the great experiment, but the great experiment also has a different meaning to it, which we won't have time to go into now. The process and everything in it and every step of it is purposeful. There is no waste. It is exactly as the old Chinese proverb goes, if heaven can create it, earth can find a use for it. The process and everything in it, every step of the way, is perfect and perfective. Yes, we do things that mar the beauty of it all. And we do things that are counter to the purpose of it all. But what we are in is so perfect that the perfection even of intentional discord is inevitable. This is a spiritual realization of somebody calling me. All right, are you okay? Okay. So obviously the divine, the source of the dream and the embodiment of the dream is present in everything at every level. We're talking about the omnipresence, and it's something that is closer to us. It's closer to us than the old statement goes, than hands and feet. The more we can keep these simple facts in mind, the better our lives will be. The quicker we will advance, and the more we will be able to be in harmony with what is going on. It's really wonderful to know that even if we have flubbed up and made a serious mistake, it's wonderful to know that everything is so perfect that some good is going to come out of it. And just having that in mind, we can help that goodness to prevail, to actually come into being. This is practical spirituality. We are free beings. And we can voluntarily attune ourselves to the process of evolution, and we can consciously participate in it. In that, we can also be co-creators, which is a complete joy. The more we know of this, and the more that we bring it into our lives, better our lives are going to be. And the more committed we're going to be to everything of which we are part. This is evolutionary thinking. The thinking that things can get better. And that there is a modus operandi. And that there are principles that are perfect. If we remember that, we can, in our thought, align ourselves with it. We want to grow spiritually. We don't want to make the same mistakes we've been making for so long now. We don't want to have people suffer because of us. And by thinking in terms of evolution, by thinking in terms of process, thinking in terms of the order of operations of things, we can do that. This is Aquarian thinking, and this is the kind of thing that is now becoming ripe. The more we can practice it, the more we can share it with other people, the more we are hastening the Aquarian age, the more we are hastening our own liberation. Now, earlier we spoke of knowing and self-knowing or being as a way of making us aware what we don't know. That is, when we know something, we understand that we don't know this. Only we don't, it's not such a thing that we can put our finger on this. We just know there's something we don't know. And that's a dichotomy of consciousness. It's an internal dichotomy that we carry around. And that internal dichotomy, if we look at that on the scale of the universal spirit, is also internalized. And so the potential of what could be, but which now is not, which is anything, becomes dichotomized in the same way that the consciousness of the universal spirit that creates is dichotomized. This means also that the dream itself is dichotomized, and that the evolutionary process is itself dichotomized. This is really important thinking. It's the most fundamental internal division. One goes to two, and in those two, in the separation, the one enlarges itself within its own self. I don't know how to say it any other way. The name for the dichotomized potential is spirit and matter. I mean time and space. But when we say time and space, we don't mean quite the same things as physics means by those same terms. So when the creative dream is manifest within this potential, it is seen in a dichotomized form, even though it all is within one universality of spirit, the dream itself is dichotomized into what is called the spirit-matter pole of being. In one direction, it is more spiritual. In the other direction, it is more a matter of matter. This is the same division of life and form that we've been talking about since very early in this talk. So there is a twofold evolution, which together with the one becomes threefold. Now this becomes as technical as it's going to get, and we're going to talk about things now and not so much metaphysical concepts or creative concept. There is the materialization and objectification of spirit in the projection of the creative dream into the unknown of non-being. It is called the materialization of spirit. There is the spiritualization and synthesis of matter, which is the objectified unknown, that transforms the experience as soul matter into the spirit, and this is called the spiritualization of matter. And as a consequence of all of this, there is the evolution of consciousness, both in the universal spirit and in every focus of the universal spirit. All of this is taking place by degrees, very slow degrees of change. Again, consciousness or the change of consciousness is not a sudden thing. It's slow in part because it's perfect. It has to be perfect at every step of the way. Now, even though the foci of the universal spirit seem countless, every focus must be attended to. The spirit must be omnipresent in everything. Now this process, the process of evolution within the creative dream, takes place in macrocosm and in microcosm. You could even say in relative macrocosm, relative microcosm. In the macrocosm, there are states of being which are called worlds. In the microcosm, there are the most minute foci, which could be called atoms, but that doesn't mean the same thing as the way that word is used in chemistry and physics. By degrees, spirit materializes into matter and back out again in vast periods of time. Each state of matter, each deeper penetration or objectification of itself proceeding more and more deeply into the unknown, has a character of its own, and it has a function of its own, so that the different worlds are a delineation of the attributes of consciousness of the universal spirit, delineated in matter in a way that has its own logic. Thought is behind desire, desire is behind action, and action is behind a state of form, a state of being. These are things that we experience every day. It's a good description of what a human being is. It's a spiritual being that thinks, emotes, or motivates, acts, and concretely experiences. But this is, when you're talking about it in macrocosm, you're talking about something in a very, very large sense. Within these worlds, there are specialized fields of activity, which are usually called globes or something like that. And in the periods of time between these deeper and deeper involutions into matter, screwing into matter, revolving into matter, there are advancing stages of evolving beings. When a being is deeply unconscious and unknowing, unself-knowing, and has only basically just a position to begin with, it's in a mineral-like state. And by being worked on by divine beings and being given different shapes, it is brought to the point where the physical shape is advanced and a new body. In microcosm, it is bodies rather than worlds and globes. It is bodies. So you then have a plant-like state that has a physical form that is capable of vital life. And eventually, another element is added from the next higher world, and that is the principle of desire or motivation or emotion. And you have an animal-like state. And then you have a human-like state, an angel-like state, and so on. I don't want to enumerate them all. In those who have awakened to full cognizance of this, all of such beings have had nothing but awe about it all, at the immensity of it, the inclusiveness of it, the beauty of it, and above all, the purposefulness of it, and the closeness of spirit at every stage of it all. We're talking about something here that is supernally magnificent. We're going to talk on a cold night, we better talk about something that's worthwhile. The phase of which, during which the universal spirit condenses or turns deeper into matter is called involution. When the spirit is withdrawing and retreating and returning to pure spirit and matter is dissolving, is called evolution. But a slightly different English usage of the word evolution than we have been speaking of all night. As intimated before or just a few moments ago, this takes place in waves. The spirit is very fluidic, and it takes place in waves which are called life waves. And the evolution is an ongoing process of eons and eons, so there are many, many life waves that pass through various stages of development. At this time, right now, in what we see around us, there are minerals, plants, animals, humans, angels, archangels, lords of mind, many, many other hierarchies. We're toward the bottom of the ladder, actually. The life waves have their own involutions and evolutions, where they pass into and out of matter at various depths according to their experience and their evolutionary purpose. During this kind of evolution, or an evolution such like this, a life wave is passing from unconsciousness to the point of non-being to waking consciousness. And during that time, it is called a creature. When it has passed from unconsciousness to waking consciousness, and its divinity has been established and awakened, it is then a creator. It is a co-creator. Our life wave, our humanity, is synchronous with this whole creative evolution of our solar system, which is much, much more than the solar system. It was begun before there were planets and the sun. It's a much bigger thing than that. We are synchronous in this, in that we began our evolution at the same time the solar cosmos did. And we have gone through the phases and periods of it in the same rate that the solar cosmos has, and we will finish at the same time that the solar cosmos does. We began at being formed into the simplest forms possible. We were worked on by divine creative beings, just like we'll go outdoors and make snowballs. We were formed in that way. And eventually, we took on new bodies that were capable of changing forms. Living, growing forms, and we were plant-like. These are all in past stages. Of course, we weren't plants like our current plants. Our plants is why we say plant-like. The next thing that happened was, in the same way, we became animal-like. We developed bodies within our vitality and within our physical form, whereby we could emote. All the while, we have been growing from the unknown to the known. We have been reaching toward the other pole of spirit, which is the spirit side rather than the form side. And we're reaching closer and closer as we're coming out of deep and total unconsciousness of non-being. We are reaching toward that which is creating us from the, unconsciously creating us from the opposite pole of our existence. This is very much like the way an infant reaches toward its parents who love it, which is the source of the most, almost all of its life. This is why there's that beautiful line in the Bible that every time I read it, I just love it again and again. It's from St. Paul. It wasn't meant in this sense, but it applies to this sense. It says, we love him because he loved us first. Beautiful, beautiful line. So the loving purpose of the universal spirit brought out of the potential of space stuff of various grades and forms in that stuff, and the forms had increasing sophistication. This was all done of bringing us from a deep degree of unconsciousness. That's something quite marvelous, if you think about it. to take the stuff of deep unconsciousness and complete amorphousness, and through almost countless experiences, to bring it to the point where it is the miracle that our dense physical body is. It is, that's, it just, it brings awe out of a person right off. Simultaneously, at the other end of our being, the spirit pole, spirit was reaching downward, so to speak, toward matter. In the divine creative being, in the likeness of the universal spirit, divine creative potential was there from the beginning. In materialistic evolution, consciousness, waking consciousness, is an add-on, because in materialism you always add things on the outside. We are capable of divine creation because that potential was with us ab initio, from the very beginning of things. It was within the spirit, and it was part of the spiritual plan and part of the spiritual dream to begin with. It was only in potential, just as matter and form were in the potential of space. See, there had to be, it could be, before there things could be. I don't know how to say it, it's a tricky use of words, it's hard. The spirit had to develop from non-being to potential as spirit to a spiritual being. And in macrocosm, the same thing was happening to the universal spirit in itself. It went beyond itself, within itself, by giving itself to something beyond itself. Magnificent thing. Very magnificent thing. This development in spirit happened almost coetaneously with development in form or matter. There was a slight delay. This was so because during involution, when we were creatures, we were worked on from without by divine creative beings. And experience worked from without inward. Even now, in our human condition as it is, where we are part creature and part creator, experience from without works inward, and when it works inward, it wakes up spiritual powers. Even the potential spiritual powers had to be developed this way. It seems to be a general cosmic principle that the creative impulse begins with spirit carries into matter. But spiritual development and spiritual awakening is preceded by experience. So the two streams of extroversion and introversion are such that the original creative initiative comes from within out, but the development of the spiritual faculty or the spiritual power or the spiritual ability is awakened and comes into being from without experience, without coming within. The spirit realizes itself in accomplishment, is another way of saying the same thing. This is important to us as spiritual aspirants, because we all want to awaken spiritually. We know that we have to create to have the potential, but that we have to have the experience. If we don't have the experience, we're again dealing with another kind of daydream. There are spiritual aspirants, and have been for centuries, that believe that spirit can awaken and produce spirit in spirit alone, without a creative manifestation. Now, it is true that there is a higher kind of alchemy that takes place on deep transcendental levels. That is true, but that does not obviate the need of spirit to give of and from itself in order to realize itself and to become more of itself in itself. Otherwise, what we're participating in is a dream creating another dream, creating another dream, and it's sort of like a pipe dream kind of spirituality. I don't mean any offense by the philosophies that think it's all illusion, and I don't have any antagonism toward spiritual philosophies that think it can be all done in spirit without the creative manifestation. But to me, it seems that they are very sad and quite lengthy byways that do not do a lot to really promote human development, or divine development for that matter. From the basic experience of form and its negative, the resistance to taking form, the deepest attribute of the spirit was developed, the will. So from the experience of form and sustaining form by resistance is how the power of will developed in potential in spirit. From the ability to vitalize, energize, and change form, and to heal and grow, we developed inwardly in spirit the potential to pure light, pure imagination, pure, I don't know how to say it, holding together of the creativity. And from the autonomous experience of an animal-like state with various different motivations, an animal can leave the form of the earth and it isn't rooted like a plant. We developed in that conception the idea of autonomy. Reflectively, the motive quality in us is reflected as an idea. And there are three ideas that are of central importance. The idea of self, or a self. The idea of a being, meaning the being, God, and the idea of self as God. From these three is how the divine spiritual potentialities in us came to become a true spiritual being. And at this point, we were complete. We were complete, but not finished. This is where we are now. Form and matter had to kiss life and spirit has to draw within its own creations consciously. That's where we are. We're awake. We can do what we want to do, and we can see that we are not our bodies. We are not our actions. We are not our emotions. We are not even our thoughts. We are what sees and sees them into existence. We have control. The process now is drawing our spiritual self or our spiritual being into our vehicles and completing the ends of them and to garnering the most out of the experiences of each and every world in which we participate. And in so doing, we eat up or we spiritualize the matter. We take it into us, the essence of the experience of the externals, even though they're all internal, into the spirit. And this is the fulfillment of the purpose on the microcosmic level. But since there are many, many beings participating in this work and each has different staged off different phased off stages of creation, there are many, many different grades of consciousness and kingdoms of being that are participating in this. This is what is called the evolution in what we are calling the evolutionary creation. It's very brief, it's very sketchy, but it is exceedingly important. And the more that we can think, not necessarily in terms of the details of this, but of the basic principles and ideas of this and how they work in our life, the quicker we can advance, the quicker we can be of help. And we all want to be of help, because that's when we feel the very best. That's when we're participating, because we are in the process, because we are necessary to the process. It's helpful to study the details of this kind of evolution, provided that the study doesn't overshadow our participation and actual living out of it. And I certainly highly recommend the study of evolution in this way. But the fundamental idea of bringing evolution into our life is a very important thing now, especially as we enter the Aquarian Age. We've had to be very brief and very sketchy because of time. Someday, I hope, in a few years, not too many, to be able to talk about it at length. Now, there's one or two other little things that are within the whole process that I would like to speak to, and that is another dichotomy, the dichotomy of means and ends. Since material is the end of the line, materialists feel that the ends are the be-all, end-all. And one hears that the ends justify the means. But since spirit is within everything, and the purpose is within everything, the ends are within the means, and the means are within the ends. And to separate them is not always a wise thing to do. We cannot neglect the means and hope to reach the ends, because if we do, our ends are something extraneous from the divine purpose or intent in the first place. And similarly, if we lose touch with the ends and get all involved with the process, which this talk almost did tonight, it loses a sense of purpose. The saliency of it all is lost. And so if our lives become empty and meaningless and purposeless, it's a sign that we're just involved in walking through life, so to speak, rather than having the ends be found in what we're doing every day. So this is a very important thing to process living, that we keep the means and the ends together. One or two other little things here. Now, some people, when they hear something like this, even as brief as this is, claim that isn't it too much to carry this around with you? I suppose it could be if you did it in a phony way. But whether we realize it or not, everything that we are in our manifest being is this. Everything from the shape and method whereby our physical organs work to the way we conceive of an idea is built right into us. And until we fulfill it and everything drops away and we are it in spirit, we're carrying it with us. This is it. Other people object to this kind of thinking, saying that doesn't this spoil it? Isn't this like missing the dance for being concerned about the steps that you're taking? I suppose it can be, but it doesn't have to be. I have never found it to be that way in life. I haven't lived in a phony existence, or at least if I do, I find out very quickly. It's like listening to music. It's wonderful to experience music. it's even more wonderful to understand the music and experience it. And it's even more wonderful yet to participate in the music and to create the music and understand it and participate in it. That's what we're trying to get to, is we're trying to get to full and complete life. Conscious participation has been for me the only thing that I have experienced at all in life, the only place where you can have your cake and eat it too at the same time. That's that. It wasn't too long, was it? It was 90 minutes even, was it?